Back together with you on a midweek Wednesday, May 12th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. Jay Hakes joined us, an energy industry expert and author, in the 3 o'clock hour to talk about the continuing situation with that crippled pipeline on the East Coast. Coming out of the 4:30 news, Dr. Rosha McCoy joined us to talk about education efforts regarding the COVID-19 vaccines. Chris Herb at the top of the 5 o'clock hour from the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, again on the pipeline situation and all. Also, the Transportation Climate Initiative, which some say is just a gasoline tax increase moving forward in the General Assembly. And I also had my own thoughts on a rather odd tweet that was sent out previously by our junior U.S. Senator, Democrat Chris Murphy. I know a lot of you folks out there probably aren't on Twitter, but just about every member of the media is, every member of Congress. And it's interesting to see what the members of Congress tweet. Sometimes, and sometimes even a simple tweet can, open a door into somebody's mind, I guess. I don't tweet almost ever on my personal Twitter. I use Facebook a lot. There's a station Twitter account. There's one for this show. We put our news-oriented stuff out on that, but I find no reason to go on Twitter and say, hey, I had a hell of a ham sandwich today. Nobody cares. No one cares. So Chris Murphy, our esteemed Democratic junior senator from Connecticut, tweets the following. He did this when? He did this May 11th, which was yesterday. I'm going to read this verbatim, which means I'm going to read it as he wrote it. I'm not going to edit anything or just change it. So here we go. Chris Murphy in a tweet from yesterday, quote, "You don't have to look hard to figure out why China is gaining on us so rapidly. Beijing to Shanghai, distance 800 miles, train time 4.3 hours. Boston to D.C., distance 440 miles, train time 7 hours. Okay, I'll read it again for you. Chris Murphy tweeting, "You don't have to look hard to figure out why China is gaining on us so rapidly. Beijing to Shanghai, distance 800 miles, train time 4.3 hours. Boston to D.C., distance 440 miles, train time 7 hours. Okay. So I'm reading this last night saying, well, we have a sitting member of the U.S. Congress here comparing train service in a country to ours, which is okay, fine, I get it. I understand you have to have some metrics, some comparisons to see where the rest of the world is. But he compares us to a communist-run, repressionist, authoritative regime that has been known for things like harvesting organs from prisoners, forced abortions, undergoing what many people are calling now ethnic cleansing among its Uyghur Muslim populations. So he's comparing us to them because they have nice, shiny trains that go fast. What am I missing here? What exactly? You know, I've been staring at this tweet for a day now going, what does he mean here? Yeah. China and Korea and Japan have all these shiny bullet trains that can go real fast. Here's a question I would have to Senator Murphy if I was talking to him, and I have no desire to talk to him. Do you think, Senator, or anyone who thinks this is a great tweet, do you think that anybody in China who might have been in the way of that bullet train that goes Beijing to Shanghai in 4 hours, do you think anyone was able to voice any opposition to perhaps losing a home or a business or if that person in China was concerned about environmental issues, water issues, earth issues. Do you not realize that when the Chinese do this, they just bulldoze everything and go straight ahead? Versus here, where rail projects take years and years and years sometimes, Senator, because of the body you belong to. And we need, you know, we should have healthy oversight here, right? I got nothing wrong with that. Maybe it stretches a little too much from time to time, but what's Chris Murphy thinking here? What's the... How do you, with a straight face, and I'm assuming this is not tongue-in-cheek, that's hard to see on a tweet, what's the point here? You're going to compare us to, a country that shows no hesitancy to take over places militarily, to take over stretches of ocean and sea and land that are disputed, to threaten Hong Kong, to threaten Taiwan, and again, in the past, has been accused of forced abortions, prison camps, labor camps, and yet they've got really nice trains, don't they? You know what they used to say about trains, Senator, you know, decades ago? Geez, how did Hitler come to power? How did Mussolini come to power, right? The old tongue-in-cheek thing, well, the first thing they did was make the trains run on time. Remember that one? You hear that through history? How could the Germans have been so fooled? How could the Italians have been so fooled? Well, there you go. So I'm not making this up, folks. If you go to Chris Murphy's Twitter account, you'll see the tweet from yesterday saying that the Chinese are gaining on us because they have fast trains. Those wonderful, warm, I'm not talking about the Chinese people, but that warm, fuzzy Chinese Communist Party. Chris Murphy is comparing the U.S. to China. Oh, and by the way, the National Review says, no, China's not gaining on us. They're now 68th in per capita income, according to the World Bank. So again, as much as we kid Dick Blumenthal here and talk about him, sometimes Mr. Murphy will just, God bless his heart, tweet something that just, hey, inspires us to be like China. I'll give you another viewpoint on this whole fuel pipeline deal, which luckily for us here in Connecticut, if we're looking just in our own area, has not really affected us yet. The closest state that does get gas and oil supplies from this pipeline is New Jersey, but it is concerning if it can happen once. A lot of people say it could happen again. Our next guest is an expert on U.S. energy policy, long history of working on energy issues. He was an administrator of the U.S. Energy Information Administration during the Clinton administration and director for research and policy for President Obama's BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Commission. Remember how long that went on? Yikes. He's also an author. Among his books, A Declaration of Energy Independence, How Freedom from Foreign Oil Can Improve National Security, Our Economy, and the Environment. We welcome Jay Hakes to the telephones. Jay, hi. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing great, Paul. Good to be with you.
Thank you, Jay. Appreciate the time. Jay, what was your first thought when you saw what went down a couple of days ago with this scrambled shutdown to this pipeline because of this ransomware attack? What'd you think?
Well, it's for those of us who study energy history, it wasn't a total surprise because that pipeline has gone down before. It's gone down because of leaks in the pipeline. They had to shut it down, and they had problems from one of the hurricanes back in 2008, Hurricane Ike, knocked out the refineries that feed gasoline into the pipeline. So we've seen this before, but it's a big deal because that particular oil pipeline pumps a big share of our national energy supplies. So whenever it goes down, it is a big deal. Hopefully this will be a temporary problem, not a long-term problem.
And, Jay, this is a kind of scenario where I think it's kind of a cold slap in the face to people. I mean, they hear pipeline. They say, okay, yeah, I see him at the terminal I drive by. I see him in the desert or in the cornfields when I'm driving sometimes. But, you know, the idea, Jay, of something moving in a pipe for thousands of miles, to me, is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, the pipes are the invisible part of our energy system. But generally, they're more reliable and cheaper than in other ways. I mean, oil can move by train. It can move by truck. And I think most of us would probably prefer not to have more oil tankers, oil trucks on the interstate. So the pipeline's normally a pretty good way to move it. But in this computer age, you never know what can go wrong. And what worries me about this is if the hackers were able to bring that pipeline down, what else are they going to be able to take down? So we've got some real thinking to do here.
All right, Jay, we'll get into that momentarily. Hang on. The guest, Jay Hakes, served in both the Clinton and Obama White Houses, and the name of his book, the latest one, A Declaration of Energy Independence. And we've got more with Jay Hakes coming up. Jay, hang on. First, traffic and weather together. Speaking of oil and gas, 336 on WICC. Yes, yes, a lot of people seeing those gas lines from southern Jersey all the way to Texas because of that software hack, the ransomware attack on that company that runs that big multi-thousand-mile pipeline network. We're talking about that. Jay Hakes is the guest. Long history of working on energy issues in both the Obama and Bill Clinton White Houses. And, Jay, so where does this leave us? I mean, we're not importing near the oil we used to, right? Isn't the most of this now? Aren't we energy independent technically or not?
Well, I mean, in one sense, we have won the battle to become energy independent. Back in 2006, our net imports were 60%. And now they're down to about zero. And we have a crude oil supply that the government keeps for emergencies down in Louisiana. So we're pretty much insulated from that problem, which is the problem we used to have. But once we have the crude oil, it's got to be refined into gasoline and jet fuel, and then it has to be moved around the country. And most of our refineries are concentrated in Texas and Louisiana. So that part of the problem we haven't solved. And to me, it's like buying an insurance policy. We've got to pay up front to make sure that we have the proper systems in place, that mm-hmm. we have backup systems that can work. And that's true for both electricity and for oil products. But I am, you know, I'm glad you brought up energy independence, because that is an idea that we thought we could never solve that problem. We solved it. And I'm hoping that someday we'll look back and say, well, we solved the hacking problem, too. That's going to be a challenge, because the people who are trying to hack into the system are pretty smart people, and they keep changing their techniques. So we have to keep upgrading our defenses.
We are
more energy independent, but that doesn't solve all of our problems.
And you're right, Jay. There's now a different level now. This is almost, and I hate to use the word lightly, but this is almost, is it not kind of an attack here where, you know, you may have these bad actors hiring these very stealthy, very astute hackers and doing stuff where the state is paying these people, but we might not know, at least the public might not know. I'm sure the White House and the NSA and all that, Jay, has more classified info, but, you know, there may not even be, even though a lot of people are chomping at the bit for it, Jay, there may not ever be a public declaration of who was behind this.
Right, Paul. I think that's the problem. If we can't, in a sense, punish the people that did it, there's a tremendous vulnerability, because sometimes what a hacker will do is they'll come into the system and see what they can get away with. And while they're in there, they can learn a lot more about your system. So then maybe they're going to come in later and do something more comprehensive. And, you know, they might use it to extract money,
or some foreign government might try to pressure us to do something or to not do something. And then we're back in the same situation we were when we were importing oil from unstable parts of the earth, and it affected our policy. So, you know, this has pretty big national security implications, and when this crisis is over, which I hope will be next week, we can't forget about it. We're going to have to come back and address it and make sure we've got our defenses in place.
Jay Hakes is the guest. Jay, when you were a part of the Obama and Bill Clinton administrations, was this a worry? Were there rumblings back those years ago that, hey, we could be vulnerable for this? Was this brought to you folks and saying, hey, it's not a matter of if, but when?
Yeah, that's a good question. I attended many meetings in the 1990s, which were about pipeline security. So that's encouraging because it says the people in government know that this is an issue and they've known about it for a long time and they've been working on it. But it's discouraging because we haven't solved the problem. And, of course, this pipeline is run by a private company. It's not run by the federal government. So, you know, it's primarily their responsibility to provide for the security. Although because there's a national interest involved, the government should certainly provide technical support, access to information about hackers, early warnings about what is observed. So it's going to have to be a partnership. But, yeah, this has been worked on and worried about for a very long time, which suggests that it's probably not an easy problem to fix.
And, Jay, I have seen over the past couple of days that there are some short-term things that were already done by the feds. And I guess they had to do, Jay, with amounts of oil that could be trucked and relieving some limits in the short term so more oil and jet fuel can get to where it has to go by truck, right?
Yes, both state and federal regulations are being relaxed so that they can run larger trucks longer hours. Now, you don't want to overdo that because there's a safety consideration. But, yes, we're mobilizing the truck supply to help deal with the situation. But we are coming out of a pandemic, and so our job structure is also having to adjust to people driving more. So I've read reports that truck drivers may have gone off and gotten other jobs. So,
wow.
You know, all this is kind of a complex puzzle that has to be fit together. And the reports I've gotten so far is the trucks are doing a pretty good job, but maybe not as good a job they would have as they would have done if we hadn't had this COVID effect that we're all sort of been dealing with.
And, Jay, you talk about the puzzle here. I would assume this is this in the White House where you've been. I mean, this has to be an all-hands-on-deck thing here. So I would assume, you know, the president is hearing from all the alphabets, you know, CIA, FBI, NSA, DIA, overseas agents. I mean, this is about as close to an emergency as you can get on a short-term basis without any guns being fired, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission regulates pipelines, so they're looking at what they should be doing more. The Department of Transportation, Department of Energy have been upfront on this. And because it involves so many agencies, the White House does have to be involved. You know, in the Oil Spill Commission, at the time, I was actually the director of the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library.
Yeah.
And but because of my energy expertise, they wanted me to come in and work on the Oil Spill Commission. And so my agency, they weren't all that eager to do it, but they had to contribute me for 7 months to go work on the Oil Spill Commission. So that was kind of an all hands on deck kind of situation, too. That one went on, you know, for 7 months.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the report took 7 months, so it wasn't quite that long with the spill. But, you know, we all saw those pictures of the oil coming out of the well. So, I mean, you know, I actually have a new book that just came out.
Sure.
Called Energy Crises, which is on the 1970s. And the oil embargo that we had in 1973 and 74 lasted for 5 months. And as we've both said, the oil spill was much longer. So if this is just a 1 week or maybe 2 week deal, I think people won't see it as a major crisis. But it's kind of a mess right now. You know, the reports from the Carolinas and Georgia in particular are indicating that they've got a pretty big mess there that they're dealing with.
And I remember, Jay, that energy crisis, I was, I think I was 11 or 12, and sitting in Dad's car, and everybody remembers of a certain age, like you and I. I don't know how it was where you were, but here in Connecticut it was, I think, certain days, if your plate started with a number or an odd number or an even number or a letter, and those were some pretty tough times back then. That was really a slap in the face, a real wake-up for the country, was it not?
Yes, although I think the public actually reacted pretty well. You know, the first one happened when President Nixon was in office, and he urged people to start driving 55 miles an hour to save fuel. And at that time, the speed limit was like 75 miles per hour and some places even 80. And people did it. You know, they thought it was their patriotic duty to use less gasoline. So that crisis was not as bad as it would have been if people hadn't all kind of tried to pitch in. And, you know, up in New England, too, people were using wood stoves, you know, so they didn't have to use heating oil. So, for the people that are too young to know about all that, I just tell them you don't want to go back to that. And our systems generally act are better today. The U.S. Energy Information Administration, which is the organization that I headed, does a good job of getting information out on the web so that people who are not in government can pretty much get the same information that's being supplied to government policymakers. And part of it, and the press is involved in this as well, is letting the public know what's going on, you know, and if there's a problem, admit there's a problem and tell them what's being done about it. And people will react much better than if they feel like they're not getting the straight scoop.
And for those folks who don't remember it, check out Jay's new book, Energy Crises, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Hard Choices in the 1970s. Jay Hakes, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Good luck, good health, my friend, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Jay Hakes. Ladies and gentlemen, Energy Crises, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Hard Choices in the 70s. The new book, his other book, A Declaration of Energy Independence, How Freedom from Oil, from Foreign Oil, Can Improve National Security, Our Economy, and the Environment. D.C. gives the go-ahead for those adolescents, 12 to 15, to also be inoculated against COVID-19, initially with the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine. Joining us right now from the Association of American Medical Colleges, Dr. Rasha McCoy. She's Senior Director for Advancing Clinical Leadership and Quality at the AAMC, trained pediatrician as well, to give us some other views on this. Dr. McCoy, hey, it's Paul at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good. I'm doing well.
Well, thanks for coming on with us and taking the time. We appreciate it. So, doctor, from a view from afar here, give me your initial thoughts on where we are in the vaccination process. Should we be where we are? Should we be ahead? Are we doing better than you thought? What do you think?
Well, I think we do need to step back and see and recognize this has been an unprecedented challenge to try to get the entire population vaccinated. And so I think we do need to give the folks who've been doing the work a great deal of credit. You know, when you think about how much work it has taken to roll out the vaccines the way that we have and the incredible effectiveness of the vaccines, you know, giving a lot of credit to the folks who developed the vaccines, and the safety profile and the impact it's having on decreasing hospitalizations and deaths in this country as we look around the world in places that don't have this kind of access, to recognize how fortunate we are for where we are. So I think we do need to look at the positives, and then we need to continue to hear people's concerns, those who are not vaccinated, and answer their questions so we can get to a place of the 70% goal that the president set recently of at least one dose by July 4th.
And I'm glad you pointed that out, Doctor. Part of your statement there was that we've never done this before. I mean, it's on a scale like this and as quickly as we've done this, I think, unfortunately, Doctor, because I hear it sometimes, there's still some people out there with all good intentions who grew up, right, in the era of, oh, this takes 7, 8, 9, 10 years to do. Do you think that contributes a little, Doctor, to the vaccine hesitancy? Is this was done in a relatively quick time frame here?
It really was. And I do think we need to understand people's concerns. But I think we need to share the fact that the technology and the science was in the works for a long time. And so really, given the funding that was available, the will to get this done, the incredible support that the scientists and other folks had, so that is really what accelerated the process. But everything happened in the same way we would usually do it. In terms of testing and safety and all of those pieces. So I think it's very reasonable to have concerns, but then to really look at how this happened and the fact that the science was already well in the works. And, you know, most vaccines don't get this level, vaccine trials don't get this level of financial support and every other kind of support. So I think that's what we have to recognize can happen when there's such a will to get something done.
Dr. Asha McCoy is the guest. She's connected with the Association of American Medical Colleges, a trained pediatrician. Doctor, hang on. We've got to do a quick check here of traffic and weather together. Then we'll come back with more on the status of the COVID-19 vaccination schedule. First, though, traffic and weather together at 4:36. On WICC. And if anyone in Bridgeport or the general area may have some questions still about getting the vaccine, hopefully we can help here with a few more minutes from Dr. Rosha McCoy, MD, a trained pediatrician, and she's currently associated with an information campaign. The Association of American Medical Colleges is helping to get out there. And Doctor, I see there's a website, vaccinewise.org, vaccinewise.org. If somebody goes there, Doctor, what can they find? What kind of info?
Yeah, the vaccinewise.org will give you information on the current information regarding what the CDC is recommending for the vaccines. It'll also give you different resources that people can use to get their questions answered. So we're just trying to provide information. Again, this is a new; these are newer vaccines. It's very reasonable for people to have questions, so we just want to be there to answer them. Nobody should feel shy about sharing their concerns, so that it is transparent to folks and that we really hear people's concerns and address them.
Doctor, you talked about the herd immunity mark, and I see figures, as I guess most people do generally, 70, 75%, 80%. Am I correct to assume, Doctor, by all I've read, that, you know, 80% would be really great, but the minimum that the medical community really wants is about 70% or a little over? Is that essentially the thinking or not?
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't know that we absolutely know the exact number because, again, we have to get there and see how effective that is. I think the 70% for the first dose mark was not necessarily herd immunity, but it was a target that the president just announced in order to get vaccines more available to folks, and because initially access was a problem. But, yes, we are trying to get to the 70 to 80% mark to get to herd immunity and really to try to protect our most vulnerable folks and everyone, right? So even folks who are healthy who have gotten very ill from COVID-19. So we just need to make sure people understand these viruses still out there. There are also variants out there. So we just need to make sure we decrease the amount of virus that's circulating so that we can really get back to normal.
Are we to assume, Doctor, that this is going to maybe become part of a regular health regimen? I mean, I've interviewed experts like yourself, and they tell me they wouldn't be surprised if a yearly COVID shot, if not mandatory, might be recommended for, you know, older folks or at-risk folks, depending upon their medical histories, comorbidities, perhaps 65 and above, because as we all know, viruses rarely go away. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we just don't know, but it would not be surprising if there were a booster needed. Now, if you think about the flu vaccine, that's something we recommend now for everyone, right? It used to be that we used to recommend it for older folks and young, very young, but now we recommend the flu vaccine for everyone. So it could well be that COVID vaccine boosters are recommended. We don't know what the timing would be when something like that would be needed, but that could be true. It's, again, something we don't fully know the answer to, but that wouldn't be surprising.
Finally, Doctor, we have seen, I guess, the two ends of the spectrum here, the new mRNA process with Moderna and with Pfizer, and the J&J vaccine, which I guess is the more traditional way with the actual kill virus or an actual physical part of the virus. So we are really attacking this, are we not, on the cutting edge part of this and the traditional way of doing this, right?
Yes, very much so. And I think that's really important to remember. Having three different vaccines makes it much easier to have enough supply for everyone. Again, just like you just said, we've never done this before. We're trying to vaccinate the entire country. So having enough vaccine supply, having availability of different kinds of vaccines for different situations, right? One shot versus two shots, cold storage versus not needing as much of the ultra cold storage. So it's just to be able to be flexible and able to reach a vast majority of folks in this country, or everyone in this country, really.
Doctor, I'll give you the final word. You know, I tell my listeners every day here on the show that I don't tell them to get a vaccine. I don't tell them not to get a vaccine. That's their personal choice with their physician. But if you would like to give them a final thought or two to the folks listening now as to why you think they should be vaccinated, go right ahead.
Well, I guess I would say that I'm one of you. I'm fully vaccinated now. I've recommended it for all of my family. When it's approved for my most precious granddaughter, who's 3.5 years old, I'll be recommending it for her. So I guess the thing to know is that physicians are lining up in great numbers, have high rates of vaccination. And so hopefully that'll make people more confident to be able to get the vaccine for themselves.
And I want to ask you this, Doctor. I hate to put you on the spot here, but can you verify that there are no computer chips or tracking devices in the vaccines?
I can verify. No, I understand. And, you know, again, I know we're laughing, but I want to make sure that if people have that concern, they'll ask the question. And it is absolutely not true that there's any kind of tracking device. There's just no way to even do something like that scientifically. So there's no tracking device in the vaccine.
Dr. Rosha McCoy, MD, trained pediatrician, working also in cooperation with the CDC, Senior Director for Advancing Clinical Leadership and Quality at the Association of American Medical Colleges. Doctor, thank you for taking the time. We know you're probably really busy, and we appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. See that, folks? See that? There's no tracking chip in there. Come on. How could a chip even work in liquid? Come on. Please. Basic electronics. I know it could be an RFID chip, I guess, but come on now. Come on. Folks, the website, if you want to go check it out and read what the doctors are saying about the vaccine, because, again, you could have concerns. Read a lot, go to reputable sites, and talk with your doctor. If you don't want to get the vaccine or really scared, make an appointment with your doctor. Either go there or do a little telemed appointment there on your phone or on your computer and say, listen, I have concerns, and here they are. But the website is vaccinewise.org, vaccinewise.org. Check it out and make your own choice. Energy issues, taxes, this whole transportation climate initiative thing. We'll get to that because, again, that's reared its ugly head in the General Assembly. But want to get his thoughts on this whole scenario with this pipeline that had to be shut down here or curtailed almost completely because of a ransomware attack. Chris Herb is with us from the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, SEMA. Hey, Chris, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Paul, good to have you, to be on with you today.
Well, great to have you, Chris. What were your thoughts immediately, and what have you heard maybe from some of your industry contacts inside or whatever regarding this pipeline situation, which I guess, Chris, luckily has not touched us so far up here yet. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. Connecticut is actually very fortunate. This Colonial Pipeline issue is affecting states from Texas to New Jersey. That's where the pipeline ends, in Linden, New Jersey. Connecticut is primarily supplied by barge. So New Haven, Bridgeport, Groton, New London are our primary points of supply, which all comes in through ships. So that being the case, the pipeline issue doesn't have a direct effect on us today. So that's the good news for Connecticut motorists.
So that's fascinating, Chris, that our oil and stuff like that and jet fuel and everything and gasoline, that all comes in by barge? I had no idea. Wow.
Yeah, so actually in Connecticut is home of the Petroleum Strategic Reserve. We actually are a point of supply that the federal government stores in case of emergency because it can be moved by barge. You know, it often, if a pipeline goes down, it will, in this case, you know, hamper many states where typically fuel that moves over through ship is not hampered unless the harbor freezes up, and that's very rare. So we actually have been able to be shielded from what is being experienced in many other states.
Is there any fear, Chris, of a ripple effect, even though we can't be affected or have not been, at least at this point, directly? Any fear of a domino effect here or not?
Well, you know, Paul, I think you're astutely asking that question from the standpoint that it would be irresponsible to say no if this were to go on for an extended period of time. We saw the pipeline go offline on Friday, Saturday. It has not reopened. We are hearing that the White House is indicating that we're going to hear, quote unquote, good news over the next 24 hours. If this were to go on for a prolonged period of time, sure. Then what would happen is that the people who need gasoline south of us in New Jersey, in Virginia, and further south would probably come north and go west to get fuel where they don't have it in their state. So theoretically that could happen, but we are far from that kind of scenario playing out.
And you know, Chris, I talked about this with an expert earlier in the show. As high tech as we are with all these different energy alternatives, pipelines, somebody reminded me, and yeah, they do leak, and yeah, they are susceptible to both physical and cyber attack. But a pipeline, Chris, oftentimes is far more efficient, cost-effective, and even environmentally safer than moving around millions or billions of gallons of petroleum products by truck.
You know, pipelines play an extremely important role in supply and distribution and are traditionally a very safe and efficient from an economic standpoint way to deliver fuel. That's why there's so many of them. You wouldn't see that kind of capital investment to build them if they weren't cost effective. So, yes, it helps reduce the price of petroleum because of how effective they are. So we're fortunate in that way to have that kind of, like you said, it might be considered old technology, but it's one that is very useful.
All right, Chris, let's finish up here on this transportation climate initiative, which at one time wasn't a tax. No, it's not a tax. Then it was a slight tax, and now it's a little bigger tax that we should all gladly pay. It was going to be 12 entities. Now it's only us and two other states in D.C. Is the General Assembly, Chris, going to move on this? And I know there are some rallies being held over the next week or so. Are we approaching 0 hour on this or not?
Yes. Well, we are now down to the last 4 weeks of the legislative session. This bill has not gone away. It was voted out of the Environment Committee and now is we're in an arm wrestle between our industry trying to get the public to rise up against this like they did tolls and the advocates. So right now we are in a touch and go situation every day. The longer we can hold the bill off from being voted on, the better chance of success of killing it off. Paul, we started talking about initially that this was a tax at the pump and it was going to drive up prices. The more that we've learned about this and some of the amendments to the bill are now absolutely going to cause gasoline shortages in the future. Don't be worried about the Colonial Pipeline. Be worried about if TCI passes, there will be gas lines and there will not be enough gasoline to supply all of Connecticut's needs. That is absolutely categorically the truth.
Now that's a pretty bold statement, Chris Herb, and you talk about amendments. Can you clue us in on one or two things here that maybe people don't see in this, that doesn't make the headline versions that other forms of the media talk about concerning this?
Yeah, so absolutely. So what the bill basically does is that it requires people who sell fuel, the people I represent, to go out and buy credits to offset the greenhouse gas emissions from the fuel. Those credits are going to, under the bill, shrink every year. There'll be less and less of those credits available. What that means is there'll be less gasoline to sell. There is no way around it. It's not transparent. It's very opaque when you read the TCI documents and you look at what the bill says. But at the end of the day, if my members can't buy enough of these credits, that means they can't sell the gasoline to the public. So unless you decide, your listeners decide to work from home, switch to an electric vehicle, or take the bus, we won't have enough gasoline to supply all of Connecticut's needs.
And also the part that drives me nuts, Chris, is in this bill where they say, well, some of this money is going to go to a network of charging stations for electric vehicles. Now, I'm a technology freak. I would love to be able, Chris, to go out and buy a Tesla or go out and buy one of these high-end electric vehicles, and I can't. So why should, and I'm sorry, folks, if you think this is selfish, but I'm going to say it anyway. Why should people like me have to pay for a charging grid for a vehicle that I can't afford? Chris, I don't get it.
You know, I wish I had an answer for you. I don't get it either. I will tell you that working class people are not going to participate in this new electric future that this government is trying to pursue and what this bill is trying to accomplish. You and I will be the people working from home. You and I will be the people taking the bus as far as we can go to get to work, because the truth of the matter is most people can't afford a new Tesla, and there won't be used ones available for years to come. So some of us will be left behind, and that's what we're trying to prevent by fighting this bill.
The Connecticut Energy Marketers Association is the group. Check them out online, ctema.com, ctema.com. Chris Herb, the head and the guest. Chris, good to speak with you again. We'll be in touch. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. There you go. The Connecticut Energy Marketers Association. How about that, huh?